Gaur Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Okay, so last night at the program at Cushion's house, we talked a little bit about the early days of chanting in Australia, particularly. And, of course, you know, the determination that Prabhupada instilled in the devotees for doing that, despite whatever adversities that we were meeting from city council, from you know, the police, etc. And because that was Prabhupada's mission, was under whatever circumstances, somehow or another, get people to chant Hare Krishna. So, of course, chanting on the street, that's one thing. It's kind of, in one sense, a casual introduction to chanting for people that hear the Sankirtan party. But that was not Prabhupada's only intent. Prabhupada's real intent was to bring people to the platform of serious chanting. Yeah, when people hear the Kirtan party, they come to a festival or they see the Harinam party, or even if they come to the temple, then general Kirtan is very nice, it's purifying, but the point of it is to come to the platform of actually being initiated into the holy name, taking it seriously, observing the ten offenses, observing the principles governing good chanting. So we see that very rapidly, as soon as Prabhupada started getting some following in 26 Second Avenue, then very quickly he introduced people, you know, to the chanting of japa. And so that will be our first major section in this seminar, looking at some aspects of chanting japa. Japa means that you get initiated, you make a commitment to serving Krishna, and the spiritual master makes a commitment to helping the disciple come up to the highest platform possible for serving Krishna favorably. So Prabhupada started ISKCON in July of 1966, when he was in 26 Second Avenue. He had a few people coming around, and he held his first initiation ceremony very quickly on September the 6th, which was Janmashtami Day. So within 2 months, July, August, and early September, he introduced, he began the process of giving initiation to 11 or 12 devotees. Some of them actually didn't even know what initiation was. Some of them had no idea even about what the regulative principles were. But Prabhupada was capitalizing on the, you know, initial enthusiasm that they had to give them a sense of commitment to becoming devotees. Of course, in some cases, they didn't last very long, maybe a few weeks. But some of the others did last, and gradually developed into very serious and committed devotees. And Prabhupada actually made that a policy for some time when he was in the setup stage, you can say, of ISKCON. He would come to a temple and, you know, he would just initiate everybody that was in it, regardless of how long they had been there. when I saw him the first time in 1972. He came on April the 1st, and he initiated everybody in Sydney and Melbourne. Some of the devotees had only been in the temple about a week. I'd been in the temple 6 weeks. But that was Prabhupada's mercy. He was taking a risk, accepting people who may not be serious, just trying to give the movement a boost to get it going. So that process of initiation then was very important. And in the beginning, of course, Prabhupada had no helpers, so he had to do everything himself. That means he had to pick the candidates and approve them, of course. He was giving them their new spiritual names. He was chanting the first round on their beads. And he was also performing the fire jagya. So different aspects of the, formal process of giving initiation. Prabhupada was doing everything. Then after a few months, of course, he began to give out Brahman initiation. And that, of course, involved the candidates. Prabhupada would, at least for the men, they got Brahman threads. So Prabhupada would chant the Gayatri Mantra on the new thread. Then the new initiate, second initiate, would come and sit next to him. Then he would put the thread on them, and then he would show them how to chant the Gayatri Mantra using the fingers, the digits of the fingers, as counters. And he would take them through, at least having them repeat one time. So in that way then, Krishna consciousness began to expand. Prabhupada created a group of committed persons, who were 24 hours engaged in devotional service. And then I mentioned the other day, ISKCON began to really take off from late 1968 onwards. Up until 1968, there were about 5 temples, 4 in America and 1 in Montreal. And there were about 60 initiated devotees. Then from 68 to the end of 71, that 4-year period, ISKCON increased by about 10 times its size. It went from 60 devotees to about 600, and it went from about 5 temples to about 50 plus. So tremendous expansion, and of course all over the world, on all 5 continents. Balimar Dhanu Pendra came here to Australia. Prabhupada himself went to Africa. Devotees, the 3 household couples, went to London. Other devotees like Shivananda started preaching in Germany. Krishnadas went to Sweden. Like that. So things began to expand very rapidly. And then Prabhupada took the movement to India. Then there was a tremendous boom there. Balimar Dhan, he went off to places like Malaysia, Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong. So like that, there was some very rapid development and spread of Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada had to cope with that. Because people were coming along. They wanted to commit themselves. And Prabhupada had to figure out now how to cope with this tremendous expansion and, give people initiation. So in order to do that, then he had to delegate the various aspects of the initiation process. It wasn't possible for him to personally identify who was a proper candidate and approve them. It wasn't possible for him to do the fire jagyas for all of these hundreds and gradually thousands of devotees that were joining. And he couldn't travel to every single temple in ISKCON to do it. So the traditional ways of awarding initiation became a limitation. And therefore Prabhupada, as in many aspects of his preaching work, innovated certain processes to facilitate giving initiation. Because the other aspect is that from 1969, after he installed Radha Landanishwara in London in December, then Prabhupada kind of entered into a new phase to cope with the expansion and all the people that were joining. He had to create a temple structure, a solid temple program. And so from about 1970 onwards, he started installing lots of deities all over the world. And in fact, there was one letter I saw where he wrote to some gentleman in India, some big businessman, that he wanted him to donate 300 sets of Radha Krishna deities so that they could be dispatched all over the world. So that was, you know, Prabhupada structuring ISKCON, introducing a very solid sadhana program. He had to do that in order to keep some discipline there and, you know, keep the devotees enthusiastic. So there had to be some, you know, program. And so he centered their activities on serving the deities in various temples. He introduced the morning program, Mangal Arati, before 68, 69, because there was Mangal Arati, but it wasn't really strictly enforced. But after Prabhupada started introducing deity worship in a serious way, then Mangal Arati, you know, chanting your 16 rounds, having a Bhagavatam class, doing Guru Puja every morning, that gradually was introduced and enforced. So in that way then, other aspects, you know, the first real ashram structures started coming in from about 68 onwards. Distinctions between brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, grihastas, and then from 1970 onwards, Prabhupada started giving sannyas to various candidates. So in this way he created, you know, a structure of different ashrams. The only one that he didn't introduce was vanaprastha, because practically nobody was over about 25 years old, or 30. So vanaprastha was something that he said could be done later on. But, you know, you can see Prabhupada's genius in devising ways and means of giving, you know, a full and complete program to all these thousands of people that were coming forward to take up Krishna consciousness. So he had to start delegating some of the aspects of awarding initiation. And as soon as he got a few competent persons, of course, and became temple presidents, he delegated to the temple presidents the responsibility of nominating new candidates for initiation. So they would do that through the mail. They would send a letter to Prabhupada, list the different persons that they were nominating. The nominees would have to also send an accompanying letter requesting initiation from Srila Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada would accept them sight unseen. He had never met them, he had no idea who they were, but on the say-so of his senior men, the temple presidents, and then later on the GVCs, he would accept them as his duly initiated disciples. He would still chant the first round on everybody's beads. So wherever he was, his secretary had to, you know, find sufficient number of beads. Prabhupada would chant on them. Then they would send them in the mail to the temple. And then the temple president was empowered to perform the fire jagya. So without Prabhupada being there at all, a person could actually become initiated. But Prabhupada was accepting the candidates and he was chanting on their beads. The Brahmin threads, of course, Prabhupada would chant on those, and those were also sent through the mail. So that was quite an innovation, to do initiations through the mail. It had never been done before, at least in our line, because I don't know whether there was a mail system 150 or 200 years ago. There must have been some system. But Prabhupada, you know, was very dynamic And he had a very short time in which to accomplish his mission. And so he was prepared to, innovate various, processes to help him or facilitate him in spreading Krishna consciousness. So also, the business of giving names out, instead of choosing them himself, then he had his secretary, or when he got a Sanskrit editor like Pradumna, the Kami names of the first initiates would be given to them, and then they had, books with various thousand names of Radharani or thousand names of Vishnu, all the different names of Krishna, and then they would pick out the names. And the general system was that they would take the first character, consonant or vowel, whatever, of a person's name, and then they would find a matching Sanskrit name. So when I got initiated, my Kami name was Dennis Harrison, but everybody called me Harry. And so when I got initiated, I was given the name Harry Sori, Harry's son, Harry Sori. Back to Phil, who got initiated with me, became Parta. And Bhakti Nan became Ambika, like that. Everybody knows that system. So that was the general standard. It wasn't done in every case, but it was generally the standard. Sometimes Prabhupada would not accept the name that his secretaries put forward. I remember in Vrindavan in 1975, one of our Australian devotees, back to Richard, who had joined here in Melbourne. He had then gone to India for the festival in 75, and he was left behind there as part of the new crew, the new membership of the newly opened Krishna Balaram Mandir. So later in the year, Prabhupada came at Janmashtami time and he gave initiations, and back to Richard came up to get his beads and his name. The secretary gave the name, and then Prabhupada stopped and he said no. And then he gave a completely different name, Bhagavata Shraya. Some of you may know Bhagavata Shraya Prabhu. He was back to Richard, but Prabhupada, didn't accept the name the secretary gave. We don't know why, but he gave him a completely different name. Anyway, still, that became the process for several years. Doing it through the mail, the temple presidents doing the fire jagya, making the recommendations, but still Prabhupada, accepting the candidate formally, and chanting on their beads and chanting on the Gayatri mantra. But after 1972, with that very, very rapid expansion, chanting the first round on the beads, that also became a little difficult, and so Prabhupada even started to delegate that. So right at the beginning of 1973, Prabhupada wrote to Rivati Nandan Swami. I think he was practically the only sannyasi in Europe at that time. And he also sent a similar letter to Kint Ananda Swami in America. And this was on January the 4th. He says, "Just now I've received more requests for giving first initiation from Dhananjaya. And now I am receiving weekly not less than 10 or 15 such requests from new students." So it's becoming very expensive to send so many sets of beads such a long distance. And it has also become a little bothersome for me also. So I think that now you may be appointed by me to give first initiations to new disciples by chanting on their beads on my behalf. In America, Kirtananda Swami is doing that, is going to do that. So now if the two of you do it, it will give me great relief. Kirtananda will chant on the beads for the new devotees in America and Canada, and you can chant on the beads for the European continent new disciples. They shall, of course, still be considered as my disciples. Not that they shall become your disciples, but you'll be empowered by me to chant on their beads, and that is the same effect of binding the master and disciple as if I were personally chanting. They may continue to send me their letters of request, along with the president's recommendation, and I shall give them the name and it will be entered by my secretary into our records. Only I will send my letter of reply to you. You will purchase the beads there and chant on them and send them along with my letter to the new initiates. Is that all right? I shall continue to deal with the matter of second initiations. The sacred threads do not require so much postage to send by airmail. So Kent and Anda got a similar letter. It was sent out the next day. And then even when Prabhupada was personally present, he started having his first his sannyasis, if there was one locally, and then later on the GBCs, doing that service of chanting the first round on their beads. So that letter was sent in January of 1973. Srila Prabhupada came to Australia the following month, and he had initiations. I remember we had a big initiation ceremony in Sydney, and Prabhupada had Madhavisa Swami, who was his new GBC here, chant on a lot of the beads. Some of the devotees got a little upset when they heard that Prabhupada was not going to chant personally on their beads, and so Prabhupada conceded and he chanted on those persons' beads. But that became the system. Then from that time onwards, from 73, Prabhupada would have whatever sannyasis and then later on whatever GBCs were there locally to chant on the beads of the new disciples. Then, of course, with the Gayatri Mantra, there's a requirement there that the spiritual master speaks the mantra into the ear of the initiate. So now Prabhupada wasn't personally there, then how did he deal with that? Now he had delegated the chanting the first round of japa on the beads, but he did something different with the Gayatri Mantra. He didn't empower the temple presidents to speak the Gayatri Mantra for the first time into the ear of the new initiates, but what he did was he made a recording of himself chanting the Gayatri Mantra. So again, this is something that had never been done before. Prabhupada used his separated energy, if you like, the tape recording, and he's word by word did the whole Gayatri Mantra on the tape recording, and then he gave instructions that that would be played in the ear of the new candidate, and that was the same as he himself personally speaking it. So May 6, 1970, Prabhupada wrote to Guru Das. He says, "I'm so glad to learn that things are going nicely in our London temple. The most important point in your letter is the second time initiation of some of the devotees, specifically Jai Hari Das Brahmachari, Jyotirmayi Devi Dasi, and Mandakini Devi Dasi. So I'm sending here with the sanctified Gayatri Mantra tape and the papers." That means he had it printed out on a paper also. So they got the tape, and each candidate got a printed sheet of the Gayatri Mantra. And he gave instructions on how they should receive the Gayatri Mantra. So he said, "Now what we have to do is hold the Gayatri Mantra ceremony according to the instruction paper. Then at the end, you teach Jai Hari personally how to count on the finger divisions. Then you play the Gayatri Mantra tape for him and let him repeat the mantra along with my vibration, word for word, and then hang the sacred thread on his neck as usual. The girls don't require the sacred thread, as you know, but they can simply responsibly chant the Gayatri Mantra. In each individual case, the instruction should be given and the mantra replayed." So, not en masse, but each person had to hear it individually. "This Gayatri Mantra function should be held amongst the devotees only." So that was it. Prabhupada, created these new systems for giving initiation and introducing people to the serious chanting of the holy names. And in that way, you know, the movement spread very, very rapidly. If it had been hung up on technicalities, then of course it would not have spread in the way that he did. So that was the system up until 1977. And then Prabhupada also then finally changed the one aspect of initiation that he had retained for himself. He had delegated all the other aspects of it, the fire, giving the name, chanting of the first round, etc. But the one aspect that he had retained, of course, was that he formally accepted the candidates for initiation. They had to still write to him, the recommendation had to be sent to him, and he had to send a letter back saying, yes, I accept such and such a person as my duly initiated disciple. In 1977, that also changed, because we know that Prabhupada got very sick in Mayapur at the beginning of the Gaur Purnima festival, and he was so sick actually that he was not able to attend the festival. Then after that, really he never recovered from that illness, because he was suffering from complications from kidney disease, and he never really got over that. So by early June, then Prabhupada actually stopped giving initiations. And the reason for that was because, of course, when he was initiating people, he was accepting their karma. So that's a burden. And I saw, actually, when I was traveling with Prabhupada, that whenever he did big initiations, immediately afterwards, he would always manifest some kind of illness, you know, either like a heavy cold or some heart palpitations or like that. But he would always get sick after giving initiations. Of course, you know, the system is that the guru accepts the karma of the disciple at first initiation, and he passes that, because he's the representative of Krishna, it goes all the way back to Krishna himself. Only Krishna is competent to burn up or excuse the conditioned soul of his previous sinful acts or his previous material conditioning. Moksha Ishyami Masuchaha. Krishna can do that. But he does that through his representatives. The representative gets some residual effect, if you like. And so Prabhupada mentions that sometimes the spiritual master gets some illness, or sometimes he has to suffer a bad dream because of accepting the karma of so many sinful persons by taking them on as his disciples. So in that way then, when Prabhupada got really sick, in 1974, he got really, really ill. It seemed that he was almost going to leave. He was in Vrindavan, I think he got typhoid. He was really seriously ill. The message came to us, to all the temples around the world, to do 24-hour kirtan, which we did for I think about a week. And then we were told, okay, now Prabhupada's recovered, you can stop and go back to the regular schedule. But Prabhupada said that the reason why he got that illness was because 90% of his disciples were not following the regulative principles. He said, it is not an ordinary disease, but it was caused by, you know, his disciples not strictly following. So there was certainly some weight on him. And I believe at that time he for a short period, stopped giving initiation until he recovered. So similarly in 1977, when Prabhupada got really ill, and then it was persistent. So in early June, Prabhupada actually stopped giving initiations, at least for a couple of months. And although new people were joining, requests were coming in to his secretary, Tamal Krishna Goswami, Prabhupada was not sending out the letter of acceptance. So there's a letter from Tamal Krishna to Kirtananda Swami on June the 6th, 1977. And he says, I approached His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada regarding the initiations recommended by your good self. Prabhupada said that for now, he will not be initiating anyone new until his health improves. His divine grace did not suggest any alternative at this time, but he simply said that everybody should wait. This is true for both first and second initiations. Kindly inform Rameshwara Maharaj to inform all the GBC men throughout the world that until further notice, no new recommendations for initiation should be sent to Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada's health has not at all improved. Dr. Ghosh, who we were waiting for, has finally arrived, but he is not very hopeful about Prabhupada's condition. So that was it. Prabhupada temporarily stopped giving initiation. So that was June. Prabhupada had, you know, been in India. He'd been in Rishikesh in early May. Then he took a turn for the worse. And then he rushed back to the Vrindavan. All the GBCs were sent for. Prabhupada actually wrote his final will and testament, as they say. It seemed like Prabhupada's departure was very, very imminent. So when the GBC came, Prabhupada told them that now if you have any questions about anything, if it's not clear, you meet together, you formulate your questions, and then you come to me and I'll answer them. And so they did that. So on May the 28th, one of the questions that they went to Prabhupada with was, how will initiations go on after your departure? So this was a vital question. Prabhupada had made it very clear. Previously, he'd spoken for about 10 years, you know, about the principle of parampara, that whoever is the disciple now becomes the guru later on. And he had always said that his intention was that his disciples would become gurus after his departure. But, you know, at this point when it seemed that his departure was imminent, now the GBC wanted to get a very clear instruction from Srila Prabhupada about how this process of initiation would go on after his physical departure. And so Prabhupada made it very clear that he said he would name some people, and he said, when I give the instruction, they will become regular gurus. He said also that whoever they initiate will be their disciples, and he used this phrase that they will be the disciple of my disciple, and he also said that they would be my grand disciples. So that was very, very clear. There was no doubt in anybody's mind what Prabhupada required after his departure. The problem was that immediately after, that was on May the 28th, on June the 6th, this letter was sent out that Prabhupada is no longer going to give anybody initiation whilst he's on the planet, whilst he's sick, unless he recovers. So what to do with that? So that became a bit of a problem. Tamal Krishna Maharaj continued to receive so many requests. And so about a month later, he approached Srila Prabhupada to ask how to deal with that problem, with this kind of backlog that was building up. So they discussed that on July 7th, and Prabhupada told him, now I'm going to give you some names. These people will act on my behalf for giving initiation. And then on July the 9th, the letter was sent out that named 11 senior disciples who Prabhupada said would now be responsible for giving initiations to the new candidates. So this is very significant because, as I said, the one aspect of the process of initiation that Prabhupada had always retained was that he had to actually personally accept the candidates. The nominations had to come to him and he had to say, yes, I accept this person. That aspect was finally also delegated with this letter of July the 9th. Prabhupada gave very explicit instructions because he had said previously that there was a certain etiquette in giving initiations or disciples initiating. that during the lifetime of their own spiritual master, a disciple should not accept disciples of his own. There's an etiquette for that. There's several letters that Prabhupada wrote explaining that. One of the more significant ones was sent to Tushta Krishna Swami in December of 1975. And Prabhupada told him, keep trained very rigidly, then you are a bona fide guru and you can accept disciples on the same principle. But, as a matter of etiquette, it is the custom that during the lifetime of your spiritual master, you bring the prospective disciples to him, and in his absence or disappearance, you can accept disciples without any limitation. This is the law of disciplic succession. I want to see my disciples become bona fide spiritual masters and spread Krishna consciousness very widely, and that will make me and Krishna very happy. So Prabhupada observed that etiquette. So when he decided to delegate this final aspect of giving initiation, when he delegated that to the 11 persons, what he said in that letter was that although the process would be that they would accept, no nominations needed to come to Srila Prabhupada anymore. In other words, he was completely, in one sense, unaware of who was, you know, coming forward and being accepted and then going through that process of initiation. At the same time, he said that they will still be my disciples. Whoever they accept will still be my disciples. So that was within the context of Prabhupada having said 6 weeks previously that when I disappear, they will be the disciples of my disciple, they will be my grand disciples. But in the interim, when he was no longer willing to accept disciples whilst he was on the planet because of his illness, then he created another system which became known as the Ritvik system, where these senior disciples would accept new disciples on behalf of Srila Prabhupada, but the whole process was with the disciples now. Nothing was there formally with Srila Prabhupada. And of course, the implication of that is very clear. That in asking them to accept the new candidates, he was also asking them to accept the karma of those new disciples. Otherwise, what would have been the advantage? The reason why Prabhupada cited, you know, that he was doing this new system was because he was ill, and therefore he didn't want to be burdened. That was why he had stopped giving initiation. So when he delegated these 11 men to act on his behalf, the implication was that they would actually be accepting the karma of these new initiates that they had approved. And in fact, in October of 1977, one gentleman, Sukumar Roy, he had known Prabhupada actually from the 1950s in the Gaudiya Math days, and he had moved to America and just kind of, you know, got wrapped up in his materialistic activities. Then when Prabhupada started ISKCON, he found some shelter there. So when he heard that Prabhupada was, you know, just about to leave the planet, he flew from New York in mid-October to Delhi and came to Vrindavan to request initiation from Srila Prabhupada before he left. And Prabhupada said, all right, I've delegated these 11 men. He said, he's a Bengali. He said, I've nominated, I think, Jaipitaka, so he can go to him and get initiated by him. And then he said, otherwise in this condition, he said, it is not possible for me. He said, later on if I recover, then I may again take it up or not. So it was very, very clear that giving initiation on behalf of Prabhupada under those circumstances meant that those men were going to receive the karma of those new initiates, and it was not going to go to Prabhupada. But to observe the etiquette that during the lifetime of the spiritual master, the disciple does not accept disciples on his own, Prabhupada kept that etiquette by saying that whoever they initiate, these Ritviks, those persons would still be Prabhupada's disciples. So that's an overview of the process of initiation, getting people, you know, to seriously connect, to commit to a connection with Krishna. Chanting, you know, kirtan, hearing kirtan, of course that's always purifying, the holy name always, Chaitodarpanamarjanam, purifies the heart. But the real business is when you get initiated. And therefore, I remember there was a controversy in 1977, early 1977. It had been building up in 76 because the editors of the Bhakti Godhead magazine had started to try to make the Bhakti Godhead what they thought was, in modern terms, more user-friendly. The use of Sanskrit terms, the use of Sanskrit names, they started feeling was a little bit alien to the Western public. People, you know, look at the Bhakti Godhead and they couldn't read it because they couldn't figure out what many of the words meant. So they wanted to start using, you know, the legal names of the writers of the articles rather than their Sanskrit names. So Prabhupada approved. And also they started kind of trying to relate Krishna consciousness to people's ordinary everyday work. And instead of it being just strictly, you know, transcendental philosophy, they wanted to try to blend it in a little bit with things that people could more easily relate to. So there was one page that they introduced, you know, which was about chanting Hare Krishna, how any ordinary person could chant Hare Krishna and it would make the day go better. So, you know, they had people dressed in suits, or they had people that were kind of fringe members who were, you know, doing jobs, businesses, going to work, and then they had a picture of them and a quote. They were looking like ordinary people, you know, not in devotional attire. And then there would be a quote that I always chant Hare Krishna, you know, for half an hour before I go to work. It helps me get through the day, you know, something like that. So that became controversial because some of the devotees felt that they were just advertising material benefits as a result of chanting Hare Krishna, and that it was therefore minimizing the chanting of the holy names. So that issue came before Srila Prabhupada in February of 1977. Rameshwara Swami was the BBT trustee. He was at the spearhead of this kind of, you know, repackaging, if you like, of Krishna consciousness. And so he had a long conversation with Srila Prabhupada. On this issue of, you know, the chanting page, you know, the advertisement, Prabhupada made the point that if you just only indicate material benefits from the chanting, then it is namaparad. Yeah, it's breaking the, you know, 10 offenses. So you can't advertise it like that. He said the point is that they must come to the point of initiation. In other words, however you present Krishna consciousness, especially the chanting, it must be with the intention that the person comes to the point of initiation. Yeah. Casual chanting is okay to start with, but they must come to that point of committed chanting. Then the real effect of chanting takes place within the heart. So that way then Prabhupada settled that issue. The editorship of Bhakti Godhead was taken away from the current editors and it was handed over to Satsarup Maharaj. And then, you know, they went back to the standard BTG format, which was, you know, straight on, full on Krishna conscious philosophy. And they introduced a few new aspects to the magazine. Prabhupada Speaks Out, where they would deliberately pick, you know, some controversial or very hard-hitting statements that Prabhupada had made, and they would feature that in the magazine. Anyway, that's a, you know, another discussion. But the point was that Prabhupada made was that when you introduce people to chanting, it must be with the intention of bringing them to the point of initiation. Yeah. Otherwise, it's useless, almost useless. Yeah. They have to come to the point where they commit their lives to Krishna. And that's what initiation is all about. You make a formal commitment to the spiritual master and to the deities that from now on you will behave in such a way that it will always be pleasing to Krishna and not for your own sense gratification. Otherwise, Krishna consciousness becomes useless, becomes another mundane religion. It's just some formality, oh yes, give a name and some beads, but they don't make any actual commitment to surrender. That's not what Prabhupada was about. Okay, so any questions on that? That's an overview of chanting japa particularly. And anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, sir. The conversation wasn't in Rishikesh, that was back in Vrindavan. That was after Prabhupada returned there. But yes, it was recorded. It's very clear. There is in fact a position paper that the GBC wrote, Disciple of My Disciple, which explains all these points. For anybody who's simple and straightforward, it's very easy to understand what Prabhupada wanted. But for various reasons, sometimes people get a different opinion. They have their own ideas, or they have their own desires, or maybe they just don't like, following the instructions. So they look for justification to avoid it. That's all. And of course, the history of ISKCON is that we did go through a period of turmoil. Immediately after Prabhupada's disappearance, as Prabhupada predicted we would do so. We had many of these senior men, who had problems. They fell down or they went away or whatever. And so that created some agitation, naturally, in the minds of some of the other devotees. But rather than stick with the process that Prabhupada had given, they look for ways and means to eliminate the influence of, Prabhupada's disciples, and they concocted this idea that, ultimately only Prabhupada is a pure devotee, and that only he is fit to give initiation, and therefore, we don't have to, then that way you don't have to bother with, the problems that arise from his disciples having their problems. So, you got this, what we call the Ritvik philosophy, which is basically an attempt to eliminate everybody except Srila Prabhupada. It's very similar to the Christian concept that only Jesus is pure, nobody else can be pure, and therefore only Jesus can save us, and he becomes like an icon. And of course the implications of that are is that if only Jesus can be pure, then we don't have to even bother. Right? We can be sinful, we can do whatever we like, but Jesus will save us, Let Jesus hang on the cross forever, absorbing our sinful activities, and we'll go on, doing whatever nonsense we like because, we can't be pure anyway. So Ritvikism is really a form of that kind of mentality where it says that only Srila Prabhupada could actually be fit to initiate anybody. And we don't have to come up to, the pure devotional standard, even though Prabhupada said he wanted all of his disciples to be gurus. Of course, to do that, means you have to come up to the standard. But, now we don't have to do that. Let Prabhupada, be the only initiator, and everybody else can do whatever we like, and we can still claim that we're following Prabhupada. Of course, to introduce a concocted philosophy like that, there's no precedent in Shastra for it. There's no precedent in our discipline line for that system. So they had to try to justify that, you know, using Prabhupada's own words. And so, you know, when they were confronted with this May 28th conversation, where Prabhupada says very clearly, disciple of my disciple, I will appoint some persons who will become regular gurus, you know, they'll be my grand disciples. They had to somehow or another twist all of that around, you know, to convince people that Prabhupada, you know, really didn't want his disciples to be gurus. You know, and so, you know, if you read some of the literature that they put out to support their arguments, the, you know, convolutions and distortions that they resort to try to prove that Prabhupada meant exactly the opposite to what he actually said, you know, it becomes ridiculous. But they do that because they become bewildered by their own motivations, their own envy, their own, you know, disgust or whatever it is, or bad feelings towards other Vaishnavas. The fact is that they just can't give credit to other Vaishnavas. That's what it really gets down to. And nor do they, you know, want to actually follow Prabhupada's actual desires and instructions. So it's a big topic, but in essence, that's what it, you know, it gets down to.
So from that May 28 conversation here, he said he was trying to appoint successive gurus, obviously. Did he ever actually turn around and do that?
Did he appoint successive gurus? Right, did he say these would be the next gurus? Not directly, but that July 9th letter where he named those 11 disciples to act on his behalf, as I mentioned, you know, that was with the full knowledge that they would be accepting the karma of those new candidates. Prabhupada was not willing to do that anymore. And just for the etiquette's sake, you know, he said that they would be his disciples, but he actually had nothing to do with the process anymore. Yeah, even to the point of not accepting the karma. He was in effect making them regular gurus, just the etiquette. Yeah, as long as he was on the planet, they would still be technically his disciples. That was observed. But apart from that, every other aspect of it, they were full-fledged regular gurus. And it was natural, therefore, when Prabhupada left, that they would continue with the service that they'd already been given before Prabhupada left. Except now, what Prabhupada said on the 28th of May would kick in, that after my disappearance, whoever they accept will be their disciples and my grand disciples. So it was a natural transition, which Prabhupada was very fully aware of. Yeah, because there were mistakes made in the implementation of the new system for some time. But, you know, we've got through it now. And Prabhupada, you know, did say that when the spiritual master disappears, there's generally a period of confusion. But those who are sincere, by sticking to his instructions, they'll come through that and bring order again, you know, to the process. So I think that we've seen that in ISKCON. It's not that we're invulnerable to problems. That possibility is always there because everybody's an individual. You know, Prabhupada would sometimes be asked when a very senior devotee, you know, had problems or fell away, how did that happen? And naturally it causes some breach of faith, you know, in the hearts of newer devotees. And Prabhupada would say, well, big devotee means 16 rounds and 4 regulative principles. Yeah. So, as long as a person sticks with that standard, then he said he's on the pure platform. But everybody has a choice. I was just reading the other day up in Moorwallumbah, we were doing this section on association from this seminar. And Prabhupada made a point that even, let's say, the question came up about Chota Haridas, yeah, and his, you know, committing suicide. And Prabhupada said the lesson to be learned from that even if one is a personal associate of Lord Chaitanya or Krishna, he can fall down. He has a choice. Yatachasita Takaru, after giving all the instructions in the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, everything, all the aspects, who is God, what is the jiva, you know, what is time, what is the material world, what work do you have to perform? After all of that elaborate instruction, Krishna turns around to Arjuna and says, Yatachasita Takaru, now you choose. Now you choose. So it's always a choice. So therefore, you know, individually, we're always prone. Even an advanced devotee, you know, can still be prone to Maya if they're not very careful. So, you know, we have to make sure that in our practices then, we keep up the standards that Prabhupada gave, and then we'll always be protected. But if we allow our attention to wander, then, you know, we may get, you know, problems from that naturally. Maya is always there to test, you know, those candidates that want to go back home, back to Godhead, to make sure that they're fit to go. So that will always be there. So, you know, there'll always be problems. You're never going to have an ISKCON society that is free from problems. Because it's, you know, the vehicle that's been formed by Prabhupada in the material world to take us from conditioned life to pure devotional life. When we're in pure devotional life, that's Vaikuntha. Yeah, there's no problems in Vaikuntha or in Goloka Vrindavan. So if you think that, you know, somehow or another the whole of ISKCON is falling apart because somebody's had a problem, you know, then you have not understood what ISKCON is. We're not claiming that ISKCON, every aspect of ISKCON, every member of ISKCON is a pure devotee. That's the whole point. If we were, we wouldn't be here. Yeah, we would be in Goloka Vrindavan. We're in the material world, and it's a struggle. So Prabhupada's created a vehicle that actually can, if we follow it, if we get on board and, you know, follow the principles that govern it, we can actually go back to Godhead in this one lifetime. There's no question of it. And we'll hear more about that principle later on in this seminar about chanting. But we shouldn't, you know, think that just because there's some problems there, oh, now the whole thing is finished. It's not finished. The structure is there. Prabhupada was very clear. The philosophy is there. All you have to do is just follow it. That's all. But don't become disappointed if somebody, you know, goes away. Prabhupada also made that remark. Don't be surprised who leaves. Be surprised who stays. Yeah, this is the material world. So difficulties will be there.
And so you find in Singapore, they are still following the philosophy. So can we say that they are doing Vaishnava Prabhupada?
In Singapore?
Yes.
They're what?
They are following the rhythmic system still. They put Prabhupada duties in the main following them. They are just doing everything. They don't follow the other gurus in the school. So are they doing...
Oh, some people in Singapore are rhythmics. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, it's an apparat. They're not following, you know, they're not following Prabhupada's instructions. They've concocted their own idea. And so they'll not get the, you know, desired result. If you disobey the spiritual master, and especially, you know, somebody like Srila Prabhupada, who's, you know, the founder of Acharya, he's set up a system now, you know, which will go on all over the world for, you know, many generations. If you disobey his instruction, ultimately it will fail. Your effort will fail. It's like, you know, when you have a railway track, yeah, two lines, if one of them is just a half a degree out from being parallel, the further down the track that you go, the more further away it goes from the other track. So it's the same way, you know, a small deviation at the beginning then gradually becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and people become more and more distant from the original principle. So, you know, we've seen that. These are apasampradayas. They appear to be Krishna conscious, but they're actually against the conclusion of the Shastra, Apasampradaya. And therefore, after some time, they become grossly distorted. Yeah. So that's what you'll get. It's, as I say, it's like the Christian thing. Only Jesus is pure. Yeah. Only Jesus can save us. Everybody else, useless. So that means you're also useless. Right? The people that are proclaiming that, they're also then admitting, I'm also useless. I'm also not fit. So if nobody's fit, then where will everything end up? You'll end up with an icon. That's all. Prabhupada. The Jesus icon. Yeah. That nobody really knows. Nobody really follows the instructions of anymore. Yeah. It just, some figurehead thing. That's all. It will come like that. Yes, sir.
On the internet, they are having so much propaganda against Prabhupada's books as well. They are selling, they have their own printers and own books.
What can you say about it, these people? You're asking about the alternative books to the BBT. Is that what you're talking about? Well, of course, that's another controversy. You know, the editing of Prabhupada's books. People, out of sentiment, they jump on a certain bandwagon. I had a conversation with a God brother in America several years ago. He was protesting vehemently about, the changes that had been made in the Bhagavad Gita. Right? That was one of the main bones of contention. That they had changed Prabhupada's Gita, from the 1972 edition, and now the revised edition in 1982 by the BBT, somehow or another was completely bogus or, deviated or this or that. So I asked him, I said, have you actually read, all the different editing changes that were made? No. Right? No, but it's the principle, I said, why don't you get down to some details and see whether the principle's actually been breached or not first. But that's the problem. People don't bother to do the homework. They don't study what Prabhupada actually said. They don't actually get into detail. And they just get carried away on some, sentiment. And, they have feelings in their heart towards their God brothers. They won't give them credit for anything. They won't, trust them. So what can you do? Then you get, all these these are how deviations come about. If you look at the Bhagavad Gita, and the corrections that were made there, it's 100 times closer to what Prabhupada originally wrote than, the first edited edition that came out. Hayagriva was the one that did the first editing of it, but he made a lot of mistakes. I mean, we're not, criticizing him for it because, they were all new devotees in those days. They really didn't hardly even know the philosophy that much. And so when, the first Macmillan edition of the Gita came out, edited by Hayagriva, there were lots of mistakes in it. Hayagriva had taken the liberty of, chopping out passages from purports and, from the introduction and other places, which he didn't think that people would understand, or he didn't personally understand himself. So he just eliminated them. And there's hundreds of examples of that. So when Jayadvaita Maharaj re-edited the Bhagavad Gita, they did it on the basis that he had some of the material, the original manuscript from Prabhupada. We still had some of the chapters of that. They went right back to the original source and restored everything as closely as possible to what Prabhupada originally wrote. I mean, there's some classic examples. For the soul, there is never birth nor death. nor having once been does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, he's undying, he's eternal, he is not slain when the body is slain. That was the translation that was in the original Gita. That is not Prabhupada's translation. That was Dr. Radhakrishna's translation. I agree with thought that Radhakrishna's translation of the verses was more poetic. So he, you know, changed a lot of Prabhupada's translations to more suit the poetic, you know, sound of Dr. Radhakrishna's. Prabhupada didn't say much because, you know, as long as his purports were there, then the meaning would be clear. But if you take that one verse, what does it mean? Nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. What does that mean? It means the soul is not eternal. It means the soul was created at a certain point in time, and then he becomes eternal. That's Christian philosophy. Our philosophy is, as it says in the Sanskrit, and as Prabhupada translated it, he has not come into being, he does not come into being, he will not come into being, he is eternal. That's actually the Sanskrit, and that's the way that Prabhupada translated it. But Hayagriva thought that that was very kind of clumsy. It wasn't poetic, you know. When you get down to, for the soul, there is never birth nor death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. It sounds, you know, very poetic, but it's not our philosophy. So there's hundreds of mistakes like that, that were created, you know, by Hayagriva's misunderstandings, by, you know, his neophyte mentality. He was doing his best. He did tremendous service in getting Prabhupada's books out, but there were lots of problems. I'll give you another example, which came up when I was with Prabhupada in May of 1976 in Hawaii. Hayagriva flew in. He had just come back after several years out of the movement. Now he was taking up his service again at the BBT as an editor. So they flew him into Hawaii to spend a couple of weeks with Srila Prabhupada, going over what was called the philosophy book, which is that dialectic spiritualism. So whilst we were there one morning, I was just talking to Prabhupada. He was talking about the moon, which is one of his favorite topics, and how they'd never been to the moon. So he said, and Easy Journey to Other Planets. So you said, I've said that it is simply childish. Their effort to go there is simply childish. And he said, I've said that in my Easy Journey to Other Planets. And then he looked at me and said, you have read that? So I had read the Easy Journey to Other Planets when I first joined in 72. I've not read it since. And now it was 76, so I couldn't specifically recall, you know, that particular phrase. So I kind of hesitated, and then I said, well, maybe. I said, I haven't read it for, you know, quite a long time. So Prabhupada looked at me, he said, get me a copy. So I got him a copy, he read through it, and that paragraph where Prabhupada said that it is simply childish, Hayagriva had cut it out. Just lopped the whole paragraph out. Prabhupada was furious. He spent the whole next day on the morning walk blasting Hayagriva, you know, for having more faith in the scientist than he did in his spiritual master. I mean, he really got into it. He was really, really unhappy about it. And then when we got back to the temple, you know, we had Guru Puja in class and Prabhupada was having his breakfast. I happened to go into the room where Hayagriva was staying with Pradyumna. And Hayagriva was really, you know, in what they call a funk. You know, he was really, you know, kind of not happy that Prabhupada had blasted him like that. And he was kind of, you know, pouting. And he said, you know, what's he so unhappy about? Something like that, about Prabhupada. I really ripped into him. You know, I let him have it really heavily. And I, you know, Hayagriva tried to defend himself. he said, well, that may be true, but, you know, if we say that they never went to the moon, nobody's going to believe that. Yeah. So I said, we don't care what other people believe. They believe something now. In 20 years' time, they'll believe something else. I said, it's not our business, you know, to present what people believe. Our business is to present the words of the spiritual master as they are. So I really let him have it. I was very angry, and I yelled at him, and then I walked out. Then a few minutes later, I saw Hayagriva go past my room in the corridor, and he went into Prabhupada's room, and he apologized. And he was crying, and, you know, and he apologized. So Prabhupada accepted his apology, but he also told us, he said, now you tell the BBT to re-edit that book and put that paragraph back in. So there were lots of errors in the early editions of Prabhupada's books. Prabhupada had already started the process of re-editing the Srimad Bhagavatam. When I was with him, traveling with him, several times, you know, new manuscripts were sent to him, re-edits, you know, to correct mistakes that were there in the first prints. And Prabhupada had a very clear policy that his editors had to re-edit his books in order to bring them up to a better standard. He knew that there were mistakes, but, you know, Prabhupada was in a hurry. He wanted to get his books out. That was the main thing. So he, you know, overlooked a lot of deficiencies or errors in them just so that they would at least get out in print, because overall, you know, 99% of them were correct. But, you know, there was a small amount that was not. The Bhagavad Gita was a particular problem because there were lots of errors in there. You know, lots of them. And so, you know, the BBT did what the editors, especially Jai Dwaita Maharaj, did what Prabhupada had instructed him to do and had trained him to do, which was to properly edit his books. So when they talk about Prabhupada's original Gita, it's not Prabhupada's original Gita, it's Hayagriva's edited version of Prabhupada's original Gita. And the 1982 edition is the BBT's edited version of the Gita, which is far more accurate and includes practically everything original from Srila Prabhupada's original manuscripts. It's a much, much more accurate version of it. So this is all propaganda. The problem is that there's certain people that are intent on, you know, defaming the GBC, defaming, you know, the senior managers of ISKCON for whatever reasons that they have. You know, maybe they were dealt with badly in the past by certain people, and so they became disgruntled. So they seize on any issue that they can get a hold of, any issue, and then put it out all over the internet and try to, you know, blaspheme as many people as possible, or blaspheme, you know, the leaders to as many people as possible and discredit them, because they have their own agendas. And you'll see that the language that they use, the rhetoric that's there, very nasty, very horrible. You know, you don't want to read it. It's so, you know, critical and blasphemous. And even if, you know, some of the points that they make are true, are criticisms that they have, but the way that they do it is just horrible. You know, you would never become Krishna conscious in keeping association like that. You know, we don't say ISKCON is perfect. ISKCON has lots of problems, obviously. You know, we're all imperfect people trying to become perfect, so naturally there'll be all, you know, manner of difficulties and problems. But the point is to stick together, keep faith in Srila Prabhupada's actual instructions, and work honestly and sincerely to improve. You know, cooperation, not dissension, and, you know, all this nastiness. That's not the symptom of Krishna consciousness. Yes, sir. Some of it's still going on, but a lot of it's been done. Jai Dwaita Maharaj did write a paper, and I'm just trying to think of the name of it. You can get it from the BBT website. where he explains about all the editing processes and why they did what they did. He and Dravida Prabhu put that together. If you read that, it explains very clearly, you know, the rationale behind what they've done. But I can't remember the name of the paper now. Anyway, go on, if you, you know, look up the BBT website. Oh, Responsible Publishing. That's what it's called, Responsible Publishing. Very interesting paper. Explains very, very clearly what they did with Prabhupada's books and why Prabhupada's books are now better than they were when they were first published, because they're more accurate. Yes, sir.
Prabhuji, talking on the point of chanting and initiation. When we hear Prabhupada's lecture, we hear quite often Prabhupada pushing his audience for and making the point of importance of the point of taking initiation from a one by group. And in today's lectures that we hear from senior devotees and swamijis, we don't hear that in the lectures that one should take a guru, you know, with that. So is there a reason?
Is there a reason why we don't hear very much nowadays the speakers, swamis and gurus stressing the need to take initiation? I don't know. Ask them. There, you know, obviously what we're doing is, you know, as I mentioned, we're trying to bring people to the point of being seriously committed to chanting. That's the process for this age. All of the different preaching programs that we're doing, you know, are meant to bring people to that point. Nowadays, you know, as you've said there, maybe they don't stress, you know, trying to actually make people into devotees. I mean, when at least in the early days when we used to go out, our whole intention was to convince a person to, you know, shave up, move into the temple, you know. Nowadays, you know, with the congregational preaching going on, it seems to have become a bit more distant, that push, you know, to get people to actually give up everything and surrender to Krishna. But that's actually our aim, you know. We're not some kind of social organization, you know, just do some, you know, kind of low level Sukriti or something like that. We want people to surrender to Krishna. That's what we're all about. And if we lose that edge, eventually what will happen is that ISKCON will become a mundane religious association, more concerned with social mores, you know, than with the real business of actually giving up everything and surrendering to Krishna. Sabadama Prijagya. Yeah. Instead, what we'll get is ISKCON Dharma, like Hindu Dharma. You know, another, you know, wishy-washy, materialistic, you know, compromised, you know, so-called spiritual movement. That's not what we want. Prabhupada said it, we're not interested in numbers. We're interested in quality. Because, you know, people have to be brought up from some point or another. It takes longer for some people than others, so they always have to be encouraged. But that should always be the intent, to get them to the point of real surrender. And if you don't do that, you're not really preaching. Then it becomes like a business deal, that's all. You know, people come to the temple or see the deities, they give some money, and we don't have to go out and preach anymore. We just sit back, show the deities, give some prasadam, and we get the money, you know, no problems. That's not what we're about. All right? Okay, it's getting late. It's nearly 9 o'clock. So, last question.
Have you mentioned that it's not that we can decide what to initiate while the guru is present, but we can finish from there if you are initiating while the guru is
present? Sorry, say that again. Speak a little louder.
You have mentioned that Prabhupada said it's not etiquette to initiate, disciple to initiate other disciples in front of, in the presence of his guru.
Yes.
And we can see in ISKCON there are examples like that.
Yes, okay, good. I knew that question was going to come. The point about the etiquette that should a disciple initiate in the presence of his own guru. Prabhupada did observe that etiquette, that's a fact. When this question did come up, it was put to the Shastric Advisory Committee of the GBC. They looked into the whole issue. Their findings were that there were instances in, you know, previous generations of Vaishnavas where disciples were initiating in the presence of their own gurus. So although Prabhupada, you know, stressed that etiquette and followed that etiquette himself, there were actually spiritual precedents which allow for a disciple to initiate in the presence of his own guru under some, you know, circumstance. So the GBC decided that under some extraordinary circumstance, they may allow, not as a precedent, but as an exception, for a disciple to initiate in the presence of their own gurus. So I think we have a couple that do that, two or three actually, because of whatever circumstances. So, you know, it's one sense, I guess it's a question of opinion, but ultimately you have to put it to the, you know, body of Vaishnavas and let them decide what's, you know, the best thing. The GBC have, you know, made that decision based, not whimsically, but, you know, on Shastric evidence and examples. So, yeah, it's going on. Okay, we're definitely going to finish. It's 9 o'clock. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. This evening, where are we speaking? Raj Vinam's place. Where is that? We have an evening program, right? Where is that?
It's in
Mitchum. Huh?
It's in Mitchum, which is a suburb towards the west.
It's where?
It's on the eastern suburb.
In the eastern suburbs at the house of Raj Vinam, I think, right? Okay, so everybody's invited if you want to come. And we'll continue on. This evening we'll talk a little bit about Srila Prabhupada's chanting of japa, and then we'll get on to the topic of 16 rounds. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Mahatma Prabhu, how are you?
Welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you.
And what a nice presentation.
How's your project going? Is it going anywhere?
We are very close to getting the land.
Are you?
Yes.
Oh, amazing.
By Mahaprabhu.
Yeah, bit of determination.
And your blessing here.
So that, where is that land?
Actually, there were 2-3 sites, but we want very close to the city.
Agra.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
City. All right. Maybe near
Taj. That would be nice.
If possible.
Yeah.
Even Lord Jagannath can do anything.
Because you're not likely to build something complicated.